All right. Well, how to think about this contribution to the conference? I say we've had a banquet of ideas, and this is the after-dinner talk. So think of it that way, except for the lack of dinner. I show you here the Pan-STARRS 3-pi survey because it comes into play later in two ways. So I'm going to talk some about neutron stars, explosions, and messengers of various sorts. Not just the one we've been discussing here, but others that have some parallels and relations to it. For those of you who know me, I am now the Clouse Research Professor of Science at Harvard. That means that they don't pay me. It means I don't teach. But it means they do take overhead on my research grants. So from the point of view of the university, this is the ideal appointment, especially now that I have cleaned out my office. And I'm now at the Gordon and Betty Moore Foundation, which is in Palo Alto, California. And I'm the chief program officer for science. And so I thought I'd tell you a little bit about that, because funding in the United States is a topic of some concern to all of us. And now I know more about at least one part of it, the philanthropic side. So that's what I'm going to do. So let me tell you a little bit about the Moore Foundation. The Moore Foundation was set up by Gordon Moore, the guy with the law, about 17 years ago. And he gave the Moore's law is that his money was doubling every 18 months. And so he soon found that he had far more than he needed for any reasonable lifetime activity. So he set up this trust, this in the U.S., a foundation. We got a bunch of Intel stock, is what happened. And now it's meant to operate in perpetuity, so that we have $6 billion endowment and we live on the interest. About 40% of that is for science, so it's about $100 million a year. For the science program. That sounds like a lot of money, and I've noticed that people like to talk to me more than they used to. And I've kind of become even more charming than I was. But honestly, it's pretty small compared to the federal expenditure in the United States. And so we have to use it in a quite a selective way. But we do have to make up some rules. I wrote this, that we believe in the inherent value of science. What I wanted to do was make sure that we said that we're going to do basic science. And Gordon Moore told us that's what we should do. Even though you might think of him as somebody who was involved in an application, he, making circuits on chips, he did a PhD in chemistry at Caltech. And his enthusiasm for science, broadly put, is very strong. And so that's what we're trying to do there. So let me say a couple of things. So I did say this already. It's about $100 million a year. NSF, I believe, is about $4 billion, isn't that right? And so that's, 40 times bigger. So we have to select the areas that we're going to work in order to have some effect. I've been there since July 2015. That's my email address, which you may want to send me something. But the main things that we're doing, we have a big program in quantum materials. So there's some really interesting physics there. Marine microbiology, single-celled organisms in the ocean. Turns out genomics is the way to find out who's there and what they're doing. And we're doing something in data science, where data science is a huge thing, and yet data science for academic research is not very well supported, and many universities, maybe yours, are trying to figure out how to get the data science at the whole university to work together for academic research. So we've been trying to facilitate that. Okay, but we have smaller portfolios in other areas, including astronomy. This is probably what you might want to know about. I show you here a vision of a 30-meter telescope. So that's the biggest thing that we're doing. Mostly we're paying lawyers who are going to argue cases before the Hawaiian Supreme Court, but we have also done some engineering. The Gordon Moore, the foundation has put about $200 million into the 30-meter telescope. Our grantees are Caltech and the University of California, who got this project rolling long ago. Everybody probably knows the news a little bit. Mauna Kea in Hawaii is our preferred site, but the construction is deferred while the legal proceedings are playing out. We do have a plan B, which is in the Canary Islands. It's a volcanic island also. It's a different ocean, and it's quite close to the border of the observatory, as you can see here. Okay. So let me just say a couple of things we're doing, and then that are in the area closely related to the science we've been talking about here. So these are ones that are pretty well underway. I mentioned the PanSTARRS. You know, the PanSTARRS catalog, the database, was all pretty much finished, and there was an effort to get this made into a public utility that was run at the Space Telescope Science Institute. And everybody agreed to do it, except the NSF said, you know, we already gave the money to Hawaii and you already spent it. I don't know exactly what they said, but it turned out that for a medium-sized amount of money, we were able to get that set up. And people use this a lot in the business of looking for transients because it's a before sample that is quite deep, very well calibrated, and now, at last, accessible. I've been helping a little bit with Assassin. I was thinking of trying to make them change their name because I think that's such a terrible name. But anyway, as you know, they do pretty much of the sky once a day. We've made a grant to Gaspar Bakos at Princeton, who's building one of these hedgehog things. The short form of it is the PanSTARRS lets you see all the sky once. The Assassin thing lets you see all the sky once a day. And this thing lets you see all the sky every second. So, well, every 63 seconds or 30 seconds or whatever it is. So that's stuff that's in your wheelhouse and is related to things that you've been working on. It's very good to do instrumentation, but it's also good to think. It's also good to think, and we've made a, I want to be clear on this. This grant was underway before I got to the Moore Foundation. Well, it was in the works before I got to the Moore Foundation, but there's a multi-institutional theory grant for Lars Bilston, Elliot Quadert, I even learned to spell his name, Dan Kazin, Stirl Finney, Sri Kulkarni, who have I left out? I don't know. Anyway, so I'm really trying to convince you I have very good taste. That's all. Okay. David Jones is a postdoc who's working with Brian Foley. Okay, now I wanted to say a couple of other things about ways you might think of funding scientific research. And there is a lot of nostalgia for some of the former ways of funding scientific research. For example, we used to have in the United States of America a monopoly phone company. And so part of the deal was that there was Bell Labs as part of the phone company. And as we all know, this is a place that many scientists think of as the golden age and their favorite place. And in astronomy, we know, of course, as in the beginning, a place where the cosmic microwave background was discovered. So in the world of capitalism, okay, we've changed over. I don't think Verizon is doing very much on basic research. And at the other extreme, I show you someone who was one of my heroes when I was in college. And that's Shklovsky. And of course, it wasn't his dogma, but it was the dogma of the people who funded science in the Soviet Union, that this was a demonstration of the superiority of socialism, and that, like having a good Olympic team. Well, anyway, something like that. His book on cosmic radio waves was something that really got me going in understanding the Crab Nebula. He wrote some other books that are kind of interesting. He wrote with Carl Sagan, he wrote a book on intelligent life in the universe, speculating about life in the universe, and he wrote a very amusing autobiography called 5 Billion Vodka Bottles to the Moon. And you know, you can do that Fermi problem yourself. How many vodka bottles to the moon? All right. So he's certainly somebody who understanding of synchrotron emission was immediately coupled to understanding the Crab Nebula. Let me say a word about other heroes and pioneers. Getting back to the topic of neutron stars, it was Fritz Zwicky who speculated in 1933 that the energy for supernovae would come from the gravitational collapse to a neutron star. Here in what he said was the most compact prediction in the history of science. He said, cosmic rays are caused by exploding stars, which burn with a fire equal to 100 million suns, well, it's up a little, and then shrivel from 500,000-mile diameters to little spheres 14 miles thick, says Professor Fritz Zwicky, Swiss physicist. It was considered really cool to be a Swiss physicist in the age of Einstein. So anyway, even though he was at Caltech. All right. And this speculation, of course, is quite interesting. The supernovae that Fritz was actually discovering in the 1930s were all the type 1 supernovae, so they're not exactly this. Anyway, never mind. And since I brought it up, I get to show the picture of Fritz, supernova pioneer, dark matter pioneer, as you know, and of course, a pioneer in gestures. Here he is demonstrating his contempt for other members of the Caltech faculty. He said, they're all bastards any way you look at them, perfectly spherical. Okay, so I was thinking about the effect of a tremendous discovery like the one that you've all been involved with. Here, for example, taken on an iPhone, is a picture of Tycho going outside, a kind of fanciful picture of Tycho going outside his observatory and seeing this new star appear in the constellation Cassiopeia. And you know, you can say that this idea that the universe was a changing place and was a place where these events, these changing events, were important. Really got going in the Renaissance, and this was 1574. The other thing that I wanted to say is that we talk in the case of the gravitational wave, the neutron star collision, and the combination of the gravitational waves and the light as multi-messenger astronomy. That's a perfectly sensible thing. I'd just like to remind you that there was a previous case of multi-messenger astronomy, and that was in 1987, supernova 1987A, when there was a pulse of neutrinos seen on Earth from this supernova in the Large Magellanic Cloud. The interesting thing about it is, of course, that everybody knows that that's the signal of the formation of a neutron star. The trouble is, you know, when the thing that everyone knows is may or may not be true. That is, we've been looking for the neutron star in 87A. Here's a composite image of the HST data, which has a strong limit on the a point source in the middle. The Chandra data, which shows there's not a bright source in the middle. And now with ALMA, we're able to slice up the molecular emission in the inside and study the properties of the expansion, but there's no clear signal. There's no signal of an energy source or a solid object in there. So we're not done yet with this connection between neutron stars and supernovae and other transients. The one case where we're sure it's there, we don't have the data. Okay, now, I do want to apologize in advance for the egomania of this next slide, but it shows the rate of supernova discoveries over the years. And this is when I was born. And so it shows you that there is a big difference between correlation and causality, that's all. But after 1987, you see that the rate of supernovae discovered went up. That's not because the universe had more supernovae. It's because people got interested in the subject. And I think this is a moment like that, where people from wide-ranging parts of science, as we've all heard, are interested in the same set of phenomena, and that this is not just one event. This is going to be really a change in the science. People are going to come in, you're in the field, people are going to stick, I think, and work on these things. So let me say a little bit more about the neutron stars. Everybody knows that we heard Stirl's wonderful talk about in which pulsars played a big role. And so here is a graduate student, Jocelyn Bell, as she then was. And here is the chart recorder with these little bits of scruff, which were the periodic signals detected from spinning neutron stars. And really, that gave people great confidence that there were neutron stars. And here is her thesis advisor, Tony Hewish, who won the Nobel Prize for that in 1974. So first time around, graduate student got nothing, professor got the Nobel Prize. Okay. Shklovsky explained the emission from the Crab Nebula, and it has a spinning neutron star in it. Anybody could see that that is a connection between an explosion and a neutron star. And as Stirl alluded, the evidence for gravitational waves carrying energy away from the binary pulsar is the change in period. And this is a pretty early version of the accumulated delay. But the quantitative agreement with general relativity really has the ring of truth. And the people in Sweden decided that they would change their tune and they would award this year's Nobel Prize in Physics to Russell Hulse and Joseph Taylor. So this time, instead of just the professor getting it and not the student, you have both the professor and the student getting it. Not only that, no, not Taylor and Hulse, Hulse and Taylor. Okay. So you're probably thinking about this a little bit, because next week, somebody, not you, is going to get the Nobel Prize for things related to LIGO. And so you might have the opportunity, if you're very lucky, to sit up in the balcony there while the people are down on the stage. And of course, the problem in the case of LIGO is this, that, that there are an awful lot of you. And interestingly enough, it's also, aside from the sort of technical issue of publishing articles with hundreds of authors, it does show you why you should use an ORCID. You should use an identifier. You'll notice that the first three people are named Abbott. You may know them. I don't. But they're all got the same name. And so there just isn't room for all of you on the stage there. And so it's certainly a great thing that Ray Weiss and Kip Thorne and Barry Barish are going to be there. As I say, I really know how it feels. Okay. So the thing that makes this so much fun is that the phenomenon that you're talking about is connected to a really wide range of science. So we heard that. People want to know what the world is made of. They used to say it was, earth, water, air, and fire. Here's the modern version of that. And in the modern version, the revision that's taken place just in a year, okay, about the origin of the elements down here has been really amazing. Now, we should be a little cautious. You know, sometimes there are things that it just seems like everybody knows it and it must be right. I think the evidence is pretty good, but it's not spectroscopic evidence of the type we heard about in the case of the stellar spectra. It's that kind of messy stuff that we saw in the light curves and spectra for the gravitational wave event. You really should take caution in the importance of the periodic table. I would just like to remind you that you live in a universe which is an accelerating universe, and as a person who deals with money, I took a look at the money in my pocket, and I found that there is all this mystical symbolism there, but it is really quite helpful to remind you that even though the thing with the eye up there on the $1 bill represents about 5% of the universe, 5% of the pyramid, atoms, including dysprosium and other elements that might have gotten made in the kilonova, are really a small part of the whole story, and that there's this cosmological story that we really don't understand very well. Okay, the other thing I wanted to say is it's been a long road, and I was trying to think, since I haven't played in this field the way Stirl has, but I did have the problem when I was department chair at Harvard that I didn't have anybody to teach cosmology. And you might think, how could that be? And the answer was, that was the department we had. This was a long time before Avi Loeb came. Anyway, I needed somebody to teach cosmology, and there was somebody there who was a visitor, and it was Svi Paran. And Svi, who's already been mentioned in this context, got together with Friedel Thielemann, who's a real nuclear guy, Willy Benz, who was at the front edge of computational work with smooth particle hydro at that point, and a graduate student, Melvin Davies, to investigate merging neutron stars. And so we saw the Eichler paper, which I think is really a very important one, and which they refer to in here. They really had all the pieces there of the topics that we've been talking about in these last few days. So they were really interested in gamma ray bursts. That's what they thought they were studying. They were talking about merging binary neutron stars and gravitational radiation, whose waveform would be very instructive. We heard about that. They make an estimate. Oh, here's Finney again. They make an estimate of the rate and say that they should be observable by the Laser Interferometer Gravitational Wave Observatory. Now, one thing I noticed is that the Abbotts have gotten in front of this person. And then they talk about the ejection of neutron-rich material, which would be a good site for our process. So, you know, these ideas have been percolating out there for a long time. This is the smooth particle hydro simulation. Oh, sorry, no, that isn't it. This primitive thing is the smooth particle hydro simulation. The thing that they did get a few thousandths of a solar mass to escape. And so, you know, many of the things that we've heard about done so much better with much better physics, much better computational approaches, and really more believable. Nevertheless, people have been working on this for a long time. So that was in the early 90s. Okay, let me say just a little bit more about LIGO. This is the Livingston, Louisiana place. And maybe that is just an old log. I don't think so. And here's Hanford. And the thing that impressed me tremendously from this most recent event, oh, I meant to go back and tell you something. One more. Let me just tell you one more thing about the, oh, shoot. about this. Because there are, you know, these papers have to be refereed. And they have to be refereed by somebody who's not on the author list. So there's just a little sliver of people who are kind of knowledgeable, but not on the author list. And in 75 years, you'll find out who one of them was. Okay. That's what I wanted to say. Okay, maybe it's an old log. One thing that's been incredibly impressive to me has been the way the gravitational wave community has gotten together to make it really international. And the benefit of that, I think, is very conspicuous from the size of these ellipses, the positional ellipses, for recent events where the Virgo interferometer has been added in to the LIGO one. And so instead of getting these lozenges of great dimension, you're able to really go and look. And of course, all the people in this room, or many of the people in this room, did some of that looking back in August. I just wanted to say that I saw this in a talk that Josh Freeman gave last week at Stanford, and I thought it conveys in a pungent way the enthusiasm that everybody felt while they were tracking down the light from this thing. And this is from Ryan Chornock, and it says, "Holy shit, check out NGC 4993. The other thing that I was particularly gratified to see was that the reference image that he had available was this Pan-STARRS 3-pi survey. So that was what he was using. Okay, so you've seen that. You don't need that. But of course, you need more events. You know, there were some lost hours between the localization and the identification. Some are going to be worse. Some of them are going to be in the daytime sky. So of that table that we saw, you know, how many events there are going to be, some of them you will not be able, even though they'll be within reach, you will not be able to do because of they'll be in the daytime. I have been, during this meeting, I have been very impressed with everyone's ability to calculate a rate from one event. I think if you wait longer now, the rate keeps going down. Every day we don't see it, another one. Not sure about that. Yeah, good. Oh, yes, that's right. That's right. And, you know, we haven't even begun to probe the variation in the element production in these events and so on. I do want to say a little word about the Hubble constant story and what it might take to really bear down on that. The other thing is that Fritz Zwicky claimed that he had invented the most important advance in intellectual history since Descartes, which was the morphological method. And the morphological method includes thinking of all the possibilities. So we've heard about black hole collisions and neutron star collisions. And, you know, there are those off-diagonal terms, the black hole neutron star collision. So we didn't hear very much about that in this meeting, and maybe we'll hear about them when nature provides us one. Let me turn to this Hubble constant thing, because it bears on the cosmology where I've been putting most of my attention lately. And that is this plot, which Dan Holtz sent me a little before he should have. Dan Holtz sent me this. Bernie Schultz has been working on this since forever. This is a probability distribution for the value of the Hubble constant that corresponds to the distance to the gravitational wave event that we've all been talking about. I think we heard a little bit about the systematic problem of the inclination, and that might be an issue. We should probably also eventually worry about the systematic problem of the calibration of the instrument, because if it's really what is the strain, you have to actually know that, I guess. But nevertheless, this lies, as indicated here, between the value that has been inferred from angular size of the patterns on the Planck Planck cosmic microwave background, and the value, what am I doing here? And here, the one that Adam Riess has gotten from supernovae nearby and calibration of the nearby distance scale. And what you can see is here's the Planck one, and here's the one from the distance ladder, and they don't quite overlap. The inference for the distance from the cosmic siren is right in between, so that's good, really. It's in the neighborhood. And if you ask yourself, well, what would it take to really have errors like the errors today or in the not too distant future? Well, you're going to need a lot more of these, that's for sure. This is an uncertainty of about 10. So if you had 10 of them, you might, if it was just square root of n, you'd go down by a factor of 3, and then you would be in the game. So I think the idea we saw those predicted rates and so on, this is within reach. This could happen. But it can only happen if LIGO reaches its design sensitivity. And that's the last thing I want to say. Here's the business end where the beams come together. And the assertion that was made to me by very knowledgeable physicists was that although they're fixing the noise problems and so on, the limiting factor, they believe, will be the coatings on the mirrors. I was persuaded that that was important, and I thought the NSF ought to do it. And naturally, the people involved went to the NSF, and they said, whoa, it's a bad year, really hard, you know, we're just going to keep the place open. It's hard enough keeping the vacuum. It's hard enough, so they have to vacuum the place, I guess, and they have to, I don't know. Anyway, so we did make a grant to the group that's doing this at Stanford, leading it at Stanford, to produce optical coatings for the LIGO mirrors. So I just didn't want you to think that I was telling you all this stuff about the Moore Foundation in order to make you jealous. It's the other way around. We're going to do something really good for you. Thank you.
Questions?
They weren't lying to me, were they? When they said the limit will be the coatings. Yeah, yeah. I'm sorry, that's the other point.
Excellent answer.
Yeah, the other point to that is, of course, you know, you could say, oh, let's do it next year, which is what the NSF people said. And that is a bad answer, because if you're going to really be ready for 2020, and your graduate students are going to be able to do this stuff, you know, now is the time to get going. This is going to take a couple of years to do the tests, and then if they do a production model, that's going to take some time. So I was persuaded not only by the technical excellence of the group, but also by the urgency of this. And so while in general I don't like to do things that NSF ought to do and just isn't, in this case, I think there was a good reason to get going on this, and that the benefit will be way out of proportion to the expense. That's my thought.
Bob, could you go back to the Hubble constant plot? Because it has been a big question as to how many more one really needs. I don't know if there's others in the room that have this game.
If this is plus or minus 10, right? That's what that is. Plus or minus 10, if it really went down like root n, okay, then you'd be, with 10 of them, you'd be kind of plus or minus 3. Now you'll run into something else.
Right.
You'll have this uncertainty about the inclination. You'll have to worry about the overall calibration of the instrument.
So
I don't know.
We are putting together this paper maybe next few days to answer this question. So it looks like we need something like 60 events to go down to like 2%, which is going to happen at 1 year design sensitivity.
Yeah. So when I say 10, you say 60.
Just to be clear, that's 60
but
events.
That's 2%. I think 3%. So that's all right. That's
60 right. Events with redshifts, everything, right? Meaning 60 events with gravitational wave and host galaxy redshifts.
That's right.
Right.
Yeah. Gravitational distances and, yeah. Well, it's the right thing to do. Good. Get going. But it'll go a lot better if the thing works twice as well, right? And the claim was that the floor that they'll reach will be reduced by a factor of about 2 if the coatings live up to expectations. And so that's a factor of 8 in volume. So that sounds pretty good.
Yeah, coating thermal noise is the design limit for advanced LIGO, so this is the only way of getting more out of the current facility.
Yeah.
Without.
Yeah.
I'm curious for the LIGO people, this point that Bob raised about the absolute calibration uncertainty for the strain, is that, what's the understanding of that?
Yeah, we worry about that a lot. It's actually pretty good. So the calibration, there's been a lot of work done, a lot more work than advanced LIGO to understand both the accuracy of the calibration and the uncertainty on it. It's technically challenging, and it's an area where we don't have enough people working on it because it's not the most glamorous area. There's a group of maybe a half dozen people working really hard on it. Alex is one of them. Our accuracies are the kind of getting towards the, we're much better than the 10%, 10 degrees we used to hand wave. It's at the amplitude stuff is the percent level now.
So we have a grad student in our group at Caltech who just wrote a paper that shows that, so during O2, I think the improvement was more like 2% rather than 10% in magnitude, in like 2 degrees in phase.
So the calibration accuracy is getting really good.
Yeah, good.
On that subject, I think a cute thing we can probably do at this event is do a relative calibration check between the two detectors that saw this with such high signal-to-noise ratio. So it's not going to be absolute, but they saw the same signal. You know the sky location. You know the sensitivity. And I think that'd be a nice sort of independent verification of the calibration.
Yeah, good.
It'd be less accurate than the 2%, maybe 5 or 10, but it'd be fun.
Okay, please join me in thanking Bob and Sterl again.